When I entered the passage, I saw at the further end, next the door, which led to the rooms once occupied by King Selim, the crumbling skeleton of a woman, robed in the ragged remnants of a black mantle, the fleshless hands still clutching at the fatal door, which I had caused to be walled up, little dreaming whose death trap it was to prove. Near this crumbling earth body there lay the spirit of Zuleika, attached to it by a fine thread of magnetic ether. Like the earthly body, it was wrapped in a ragged robe of black, of which it seemed the counterpart. A corner of this robe was drawn over Zuleika's head and face, veiling it from my eyes. I drew near to her with feelings of the deepest emotion, for though as I gazed at her crumbling form, I knew that the passionate love with which I had once regarded her was dead, slain by the knowledge of her falseness, it was not possible to feel towards her as towards any other woman. The tie between us had been too sacred, too tender. No man who has once truly felt the holy emotion of a pure love can ever regard with indifference the woman who has lain within his arms, and borne to him the most sacred relationship of all. Yea, though that woman may prove as false as sin. Though she may have trampled on his affection as on a worthless rag, and trifled with his heart as a child toys with a plaything. For the man who has once truly loved her, she will ever be surrounded with the halo of the infinite tenderness of a love that has no counterpart save in the still purer, holier love of a mother for her child. In mine anger, when I first knew of her falseness and my dishonor, I could have killed Zuleika with mine own hand, but even had I done so, her death would have filled me with an infinite anguish of remorse so soon as ever the fatal deed had been done. And now as I looked down upon her, and knew that she, too, was dead, and by what means she had died, my heart was torn by the violent passion of anger and sorrow. I loved her no longer as I once had done. Could she have risen before me in all the pure beauty of her earthly days, I should have still drawn aloof from her, knowing her nature as I knew it now. But nevertheless my heart was hot against her murderess, and I could have cried aloud with anguish when I thought of her cruel sufferings ere she died. If aught could have added fuel to the fire of my anger against Artemisia, the sight of Zuleika would have done so, and I vowed a yet more fearful oath to sacrifice all other things unto my purpose of revenge. Trembling with emotion, I drew near to Zuleika, thinking to raise gently one corner of the robe, which hid her face, that I might gaze but once again upon the features so dear to mine eyes in the long past days, on earth. Ere I could touch her, however, the veil that shrouded her face became transparent as gauze, and revealed to mine eyes, not the lovely features of my once wife, but the shrunken, withered face of an old woman, stamped with an expression of vice and shame such as one sees on some wretched woman in the streets, who had sold herself for gold. Ye powers! I cried in horror, is this Zuleika's spirit after all, or have I made some strange mistake? Then I looked again, more closely, and I saw that it was indeed the Zuleika I had loved. The features were the same, but the blighting hand of sin and treachery had rested on them, stamping on them the true impress of the shallow, sensual soul beneath the once fair exterior. The expression was the same as she had ever worn in Jalaluddin's mirror. Only now there were no charms of feature to redeem its hideousness. I turned away, saddened at the sight, and filled with my passion against the woman whose hand had helped to shed such ruin around me. I willed to see her next, that I might stand face to face with her once more. Chapter 7, The Sea of Passion, Teachings on the Separation of Spiritual Spheres, We Plot Against Artemisia. I found myself standing at last beside a lone sea, whose dark billows dashed furiously upon the mighty rocks, which like a wall of iron shut it in. Here and there were bleak patches of sandy shore, like barren resting places amidst a wilderness of jagged rocks and stormy waves. A furious hurricane, whose hot breath was like the scorching blast of a sirocco, seemed to rage there eternally, driving the mighty waters upon those towering rocks with the re-echoing roar of thunder, and scattering great volumes of spray far over the wild dark plains that lay beyond this troublous sea. Storm clouds hovered overhead, and the fiery magnetism cast off from the stormy souls of those who had created this scene of passion rent the sky in all directions with their lightning flash, while the deep, reverberating roll of the giant waves and wind fell on the ear unceasingly. Great as is the range of the spiritual sight compared to that of mortal life, it was yet too limited to show me the extent of this vast ocean that stretched away beyond the powers of even my thoughts to follow. I climbed to the highest point of a lofty rock and, looking along the far extending shores, beheld at last, at an immense distance, a solitary woman's figure, that I felt, with a sudden rush of savage joy, to be that of Queen Artemisia. Quick as thought I sped towards her, but when I came near I found that some invisible barrier, through which I could by no means pass, separated me from her. In vain I sought to get nearer, a wall of iron kept me back, and no efforts of mine could break through it. Furious with rage, I at last gave up the useless attempt. A mocking laugh at my side made me turn round, to behold Mansur beside me. "Waste not your powers in useless efforts," said he, "for you art on the confines of two spheres, and you canst not pass from the one unto the other. Between you and Artemisia there is a barrier of antagonistic magnetism, which to your spirit body is even more impassable than a wall of stone would have been to your mortal envelope. If you wouldst attack your enemy, it must be by other agency than your own hands. To do so you wilt need the help of those beings whom the Dark Angel had given you as servitors, and such knowledge of their attributes and the laws, which govern them as I only can give you. Your spiritual magnetism and Artemisia's are as diametrically opposite as the two poles, as antagonistic as two gases, which can in no wise blend, so violent is the force of their repulsion. Neither of you can by any means come again into personal contact with the other, unless you can indeed restore the conditions of earth life. For in the earth life all spheres are mingled, and the gross materiality of the earthly envelope enables those whose magnetisms are intensely antagonistic, to draw near unto each other, even as you may imprison the two opposing chemical gases in separate vessels and thus bring them into a closeness of proximity impossible to them when free. Dost you imagine that were it possible for Artemisia to meet you, she would not herself have long since sought you out? On the night when you were slain, she also died, from poison administered by the orders of Prince Ahmed. Unlike you, her spirit was fully ripe for the great change. She awoke almost at once, as one wakes from slumber, and since that hour she has not ceased to call upon your name. She thirsts as much or more than you for the long-deferred meeting with you, her great enemy, and she cannot understand wherefore you hast not obeyed her summons. She is ignorant of all laws pertaining unto spiritual conditions. Such studies have no attraction for her. She thinks only of what the priests have taught her, and cares not to gain even the most elementary knowledge of that state of existence in which she now finds herself. Behold her now, and mark well what fruits her crimes have borne for her, and then will I show you how you may add yet another drop unto the full cup of her bitterness. As he pointed to the restless figure of the queen, Mansur passed his hands slowly over my head, and then it was as though a clearer measure of sight had been given to me, for I not only saw Artemisia herself, but the multitude of beings, which thronged around her every footstep. I heard moreover every word she uttered. "Look now," said Mansur, "see how those haunting shapes dog her footsteps, each the embodiment of a past crime. She does not know that they are things of air, mere creatures of her thoughts. Reflections thrown upon her own aura as an image is thrown upon the surface of a mirror. She thinks each horrid shape is real, a sentient being like herself, and knows not were she to turn and face them calmly, to contemplate them steadily, they would melt like mist. See how each angry vengeful thought had shaped itself into a giant phantom in her mind. See yonder shade dipping its gory hands again and yet again into a deep pool of blood. Behold, it is but the picture, which memory gives back of herself as she sat beside you in your dying hour. See yon crowd of hellish imps that scream and shriek around her, they are the curses she had heaped on others' heads, and which have now come back to her. Each one but repeats her own words, each does but embody her own thoughts when she uttered them. Again, see yonder that white, floating figure. Dost you recognize it, with its stony angel face as of a slumbering child and its white robes dyed with the fast flowing blood from the wounds in neck and shoulder? 'Tis the wraith of your murdered mother. Nay, start not. The pure soul is not there, She rests in paradise. That floating phantom is but the last fading remnant of the astral shell cast off long since by the risen soul, and only retained thus long in its integrity by the constant thought of Artemisia herself, who can in no wise free herself from the memory of her victim. She thinks it is the spirit that haunts her and had haunted her through these many years. She doth not know that between herself and the murdered Cynthia there exists an antagonism as great as between herself and Cynthia's son, and that it is therefore impossible that their souls can ever meet in the spirit sphere. She can behold yon crumbling astral shell even as she might have beheld the poor earth body she destroyed, but unless Cynthia could reclothe herself in an earthly body, Artemisia can never again behold her spirit. As for this haunting shell, were only Artemisia to have courage enough to touch it, it would crumble beneath her hand, and turn to ashes for the first breeze to scatter. Artemisia is alone by this wild sea. Naught haunts her but her own foul thoughts, her own murderous deeds. Yet in the vividness with which they are presented to her eyes, doth you not perceive how one who had the knowledge of how to create such shapes may torment her yet more sorely? See now, she calls upon her son, her only son, the one thing that can awaken still the tender emotions of her soul. Mark with what frantic despair she calls on him, realizing that even death had not bridged over the gulf created by death between them. Canst you think of no means here to be revenged upon her, to make her suffer even as she had made you? Hast you not felt that even the oblivion of death, the mere dropping of its dark veil between you and the object of your affections, were a mercy compared to the worse than death, which had separated you from your beloved? Doth it not then occur to your mind that you couldst so torture Artemisia through these pictures that she would almost pray in her anguish to be left rather to the present uncertain knowledge of her son's fate, to the still cherished hope that he is in paradise? You canst do nothing to the queen herself. Her own state of misery is too deep for you to add one feather's weight unto the burden. But in her thoughts of her son she finds the one faint hope that yet glimmers amidst the darkness of her despair. On earth she thought that she would fain he had gone to hell, so that she might see him again. Now that she herself is here, the mother's soul recoils from such a fate for her adored child. She would rather dwell here herself for all eternity than drag him down even for 1 hour. And though she calls thus frantically upon his mind, she does so only in the hope that a far-off glimpse of him may at last be accorded to her, not with the desire to bring him into the same condition as herself. Manzoor drew closer to my side, and clutching my arm as in a vice, hissed into mine ears, "Dost you not understand me yet? Art you so dull of thought as not to see that you canst slay even this one hope? This one faint alleviation of Artemisia's lot by casting your spells upon her? I will even show you how it may be done, and how you may drive her to despair beside, which her present state were as paradise." The fierce cruelty of this spirit's look and voice appalled me as he whispered his suggestions in mine ears. Yet was mine own anger against the queen so deep that even while I shuddered at the suggestions of the dark spirit, I yet felt loath to refuse his aid. As before, he must have read my thoughts, for with a bitter sneer he said, "You art a pretty one to vow vengeance against your enemy, and then when the way is shown to you, shrink like a timid babe because its darkness appalls you. Wander through these realms and see what pity they who reign here show to one another, and then ask thyself if you art fit to lord it over hell's dark spirits. He who would reign here must leave remorse behind, must part with the last lingering shadow of compunction, or his weakness will cause him to be hurled underfoot and trampled down like the wretched slaves whom you shall see thick as leaves in autumn, cumbering the ground on every side, and serving like beasts of burden those whose stupendous wickedness had raised them above all lesser sinners. Come, return with me now unto the sphere in which you was before, and I will show you what manner of servants the dark angel had given you." Chapter 8, The Vengeance Pack of Inferno. How to dominate them. Intelligence rules in hell as well as in heaven. How astral sprites affect humanity. Disease poisons. Under the guidance of Manzoor, I soon found myself again on the spot where I had had my interview with the dark angel. At the command of my fiendish guide, The strange and fearful creatures who were to serve as instruments of my vengeance gathered from all directions and clustered around us once more. Some were like Hunter the dragons of fable, whose huge bodies were like the combination of several monstrous reptiles. Others were like wolves, and horrible mixtures of more than one species of ferocious beasts. Horrible vultures of gigantic size swooped down to join the throng. All the most loathsome creatures known on Earth were reproduced here, with still more repulsive blending of the evil qualities of each. There were some creatures like unto black cats in the shape of the bodies, yet with flat, wide heads and two enormous teeth like tusks, which projected from either jaw, while the small teeth were sharp and jagged like the teeth of a saw, and they had claws of extraordinary size and sharpness. I could well fancy these creatures tearing their prey to pieces in the most horrible manner with such teeth and claws. They attracted my attention especially because there were so many of them, and because they hung around me more closely than did any of the other distorted representations of animal life on Earth. These astral animals and birds seemed a distinct and almost material class in themselves. The semi-human impish-looking creatures, which I have described as being the creations of the passions of man's animal souls, came next in order. Then there were low, earth-bound spirits who were distinctly human, and who had lived an earth life of much evil and degradation, but who, because of the fact that they possessed souls, were of a degree of intelligence far beyond the other soulless creatures. Some of these unfortunate earth-bound spirits were, however, of so very low a type of human life, so slightly developed in intellect, that it required a fine perception to distinguish between them and those who were semi-human and soulless. Above this class of earth-bound spirits I saw others, far superior in their intellectual development, far more unmistakably responsible individuals, but who were of so repulsively evil a type of wickedness that it was impossible not to shrink from all approach to contact with them. Despite the savage, bestial expression on their faces, despite the horrible resemblance they bore in action, and even in some cases in feature, to the wild beasts around me, I knew that these were indeed the spirits of men and, alas, of women, for there were among them some hideous travesties of womanhood. That they were born as the offspring of lives of the most revolting cruelty and wickedness on earth, and that the higher faculties of their souls should be literally still in the germ state, only made the sight of them the more terrible, since immense periods of time must of necessity elapse ere those undeveloped seeds of good within their souls would begin to grow. As Manzur pointed them out to me, he said, "Behold those beings whose cowardly cruelty makes of them the most abject and yet the most dangerous of your slaves. If you wouldst dominate them, you must possess the most unceasing watchfulness, the most relentless determination, and should they hesitate to obey you, you must at once consign them to the most cruel punishments at the hands of their savage fellows. If you dost show to them one atom of pity, they will cease to fear you, and will turn to rend you in pieces at the first chance. Remember, that in this sphere their strength of body is ever greater than you, because they possess a more dense degree of materiality than you. This is their sphere, and you art in a manner an intruder. If you art to reign here, it must be by the force of your will, the power of your intellect, the degree of your knowledge of spiritual laws, not by mere brute force, for the strength of such beings as those around you is stupendous. Were they once freed from the restraint that is ever exercised over them in spirit life by the higher intelligences, these beings possess a strength sufficient to destroy all the forms of life on earth, which are higher than themselves. At present they may be said to be imprisoned in the limits of this sphere, and amongst creatures of their own kind. To enable them to act upon the inhabitants of any other sphere, or to affect the material things of earth life, it is necessary that they be brought under the influence of the will of some spirit or mortal strong enough and intelligent enough to counteract the will force, which now holds them in bondage. Once they are fully dominated by some powerful spirit, either in or out of the flesh, they can be used like a mass of puppets, and when they are brought into contact with certain magnetic conditions in earth life, they possess a force sufficient to enable them to move large obstructions as one would lift a feather. Their magnetism may be said to resemble a powerful explosive gas, whose expansive force can shatter the strongest masonry, and the pressure they can bring to bear upon the mortal envelope of man would be great enough to crush his earthly body into a shapeless mass, as though the chariot wheels of the great god of thunder had passed over it. With Jalal ad-Din you did see somewhat of the powerful nature of certain chemical fumes that he distilled, but you canst but faintly conceive as yet of the vastness of the hidden powers in nature, and still less canst you realize that, compared with the powers possessed by spiritual nature, those of the material earth are but as children's playthings. In all the wondrous tales told of the miraculous things which have been wrought by the power of magic, the basis of the power called into action was this influence of the master mind of the magician upon these almost material astral beings. Under the controlling will of their master, they did mighty works, transporting objects to a great distance, or acting as a destroying force upon some enemy. Most often their aid has been invoked solely for purposes of evil, for as a rule those who sought their aid did so in order to grasp at boundless power, and minister to their all-absorbing ambition. Yet there is no reason why their services should not be made use of for good as well as for evil, save that, drawing such a force as this around a mortal brings up from the dark depths of the infernal regions, a countless host of kindred spirits, whose influence it is difficult to shake off again. When I tell you that these beings are dominated by the wills of the higher intelligences, I mean not alone that higher intelligence, which is devoted to goodness and purity. Evil is in all respects as powerful as good. The higher degree of knowledge and intellectual power belongs to evil as much as to good, and the mind can travel as far and as fast in the one direction as in the other during its pursuit of knowledge. Do I not know this only too well? But as the nature of these particular classes of astral beings is essentially evil, it follows that they are more often controlled by the evil intelligences with whom they are in affinity than by the good, to whom they are antagonistic. What then, I asked, protects man on earth from these beings, since you doth suggest they have the power to affect material things? I said unto you that under certain conditions they have the power. That is to say, they have it when there is a mortal brought into proximity to them in whose aura they find the highly magnetic essence of, which I told you before, an essence, which supplies to them the link between the materiality of man and their own state, that subtle form of ether, which, as I said unto you, serves to hold in combination the material atoms of the human body, and, which, when it surrounds these beings, gives to them for the moment almost the density of mortals, so that they can bring their extraordinary magnetic power to bear upon mortal things. You thyself possessed this subtle essence in your earth life, in spirit life even as it would have served you on earth had you but known how to use it. It was because the essence was present with you that you did see the hands and faces, the figures even of the strange creatures, which hovered around you and Jalal ad-Din during your studies, and it is those mortals who possess this magnetic aura who have most to fear from the proximity of these astra is. But, said I, doth not the fact that the aspirations of mankind are towards good rather than evil, so that dilt preponderating influences around man tend to good, serve to protect him in a measure from evil? Yea, you art right, replied Mansur, yet evil is still a mighty power upon the earth, and when you hast steeped your soul deep in its pleasures, how hard it is to shake it off! How difficult to rise to higher things! How bald and tame seem the joys of the pure and good! He sighed, and I could not help thinking that perhaps after all he was not so far as he imagined from all appreciation of those purer joys. Then the softer mood passed, and he turned to me again with the zest of a true teacher in expounding his views unto an eager pupil, and continued his discourse. Now that you hast seen these beings, you wilt not wonder that in calling such unto their aid, the daring mortals who have sought to subjugate them are so often themselves destroyed by the very force they have called up. He whose will releases these spirits from their bondage to the higher intelligences, in order that they may become the unseen tools with which he wreaks his animosity upon a fellow mortal, is apartment to forget that he had created a link between himself and these astral beings, which he may be afterwards powerless to sever. Do you see how the restless throng are chafing already at the restraint put upon them? How they long to be at some hellish work again? Mark those great bags, like huge black spidery webs, that some of them carry. See, I will suffer them to follow out the thought which had come unto their minds. Manzura waved his hand, and instantly the dark throng of human and semi-human beings rushed upon the hideous animals around them, and despite their teeth and claws, thrust a number of them into the great nets. Then, amidst much yelling and quarreling, they made a ring, and tumbling the savage creatures out of the bags pell-mell on the top of each other, prodded and buffeted them till the whole angry mass were tearing each other to pieces like a lot of hungry rats and wolves. As the creatures tore at one another, the most frightful vapor arose, the most sickening odor, the most poisonous stench possible to imagine. I felt myself becoming stifled, and looked at Manzur to see whether he was playing some diabolical trick upon me. But he drew from his robe a long slender wand, and waving it slowly before us, created a wind, which blew the poisonous stench away. "It is as well that you hast smelt that sweet savor," said he, "because now you canst judge how deadly unto the spirit is the magnetism thrown off from these creatures. You canst understand how a sensitive mortal exposed to their subtle influence would sicken and die. None could tell wherefore, because no mortal sense is keen enough to detect this poison. You hast heard that poison can be dropped into the heart of a rose, so that the scent of the flower shall hide the death-giving odor, and the fair beauty of the flower tempt the victim to wear it. The most subtle poisons are the most deadly, and it is these poisons which act directly on the spirit. The earthly envelope is designed as a shield to the spirit in the earth life, even as the more spiritual bodies of the succeeding stages protect the soul in those more advanced conditions of its existence. If then, the earthly envelope be so far penetrated by the spirit that an abnormal degree of sensitiveness is experienced, it stands to reason that this thinner envelope leaves the spirit exposed to the action of these subtle influences, and liable to be injured by them to an extent from which the more grossly enveloped spirit is protected. The poison of disease cannot be detected by the power of sight, yet it is none the less present in the atmosphere, and as with increasing knowledge upon earth men will be able to detect the approach of the destroying pestilence, so with a more universal knowledge of magnetic laws, men will become at last able to detect the approach of those more subtle poisons, which produce the spiritual pestilences by infusing their deadly vapors into the atmosphere of spiritual life. Chapter 9. The plot unfolded. We visit Selim, suffering for the sins of a mother, and how dost you intend to use these creatures for the furtherance of your plans against Artemisia? Said I to Manzur at last, for in his delight at finding one who took an interest in his discourse, he seemed to have forgotten all but the scientific aspect of the subject. As my question recalled him to the original purpose of our meeting, the dark, fiendish expression passed again over his face, and with a low chuckle of diabolical cunning he said, "Artemisia had escaped all knowledge of this sphere, the astral circle of the earth plane, because she had sunk to one below it, as you also wouldst have done had it not been that in your earthly life you did form many links between this sphere and thyself. We cannot take these companions around us to the queen, and thus cheer her solitary hours with their sportive gambols. But Selim is yet within the confines of this sphere. He hovers around the earth plane, and we can visit him. You hast much influence over him, for in your earth lives, it was well established. Moreover, ye are the offspring of one father, and between you there is not so great a measure of antagonism as between you and Artemisia. She had escaped our clutches, but her son is here and we can visit him. He is in our power. You canst surround him with all the horrors which the hellish creatures beside us can wreak upon their victims. You canst paralyze his will with the strong force of your own, which could ever dominate his. You canst give him over as a helpless captive into the hands of these beings around us, and of a surety 'twill be fine sport to see what they will do unto him. Then through him you canst project unto Artemisia the knowledge of his condition. His thoughts will reach her though you cannot. If you dost direct the thoughts of Selim unto his mother, and will that he desires her to behold his state, then will a picture of Selim be thrown upon the mirror-like atmosphere around her, and appear as real to her eyes, as objective and as near as do her own thoughts, which at present fill all her mental horizon. Through Selim she will behold you, and will learn that you hast him in your clutches, while she herself is powerless to aid him in any way. Dost you not think it is a pretty scheme? Doth it not seem to you that you wilt extract a far keener anguish from Artemisia by torturing her son than if you couldst touch herself? For herself, she would defy you. Her spirit is as courageous and as dauntless as your own, woman though she be. But when you doth touch her son, she will have no power to do aught, her spirit will lie broken, and she will sue to you for mercy like the veriest slave. There will be no depths of humiliation to which you canst not reduce her, if only you dost secure her son, her only son.